82 IVP.
You are quite right. That is the nature of dynamite. Dynamite wasn't particularly an invention. It's not the explosive itself. It's a packaging of trinitrotoluene, nitroglycerin rather. The other explosive being trinitroglycerin, the old TNT. So yes, it wasn't a substance. It was more of a storage technology that he patented and made lots of money.
See, not to correct you, but TNT is trinitrotoluene, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, what did I say, toluene? It's the same thing.
Sorry, maybe I misheard. My bad.
Fine, I make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. Anyway, getting back to the question at hand. So I'm trying to kind of cajole you into thinking about these things a little bit. J.J. Thompson, a very smart guy. And matter of fact, it goes back to a conversation that was earlier in the TechNet about cathode ray tubes, because one of the things that he investigated a great deal was cathode rays, which he figured out were charged and were particles. He also worked on something called anode arrays, which if you can kind of figure out what that might have been, that was positively charged objects. He couldn't really get protons to the nucleus at that time, not that he knew that they were there, but they were positively charged ions. So they were also called the canal rays. So canal rays or anode rays were ions, and cathode rays were what he called muscles, or we call electrons. Let me drop for a second. Matter of fact, he had a very intriguing experiment with a canal ray. He took neon, and he charged it. He turned it into ions, and he checked. He also was very interested in the mass charge ratios, which he could perceive by applying an external electric or magnetic field and seeing the deflection. So he pretty much was the guy who invented how mass spectrometers work. But in addition to figuring out the charge mass ratio of an electron and such, he also put the neon through a similar device and found that it diffracted, it bent in two different groups. And what he had discovered were isotopes, because with different nucleuses, it had different mass. With different mass, it had different charge mass ratios and different deflections. So he discovered electrons, and he discovered isotopes, and he basically discovered the mass spectroscopy device. Let me drop for a second. Now, the thing is that we kind of know quantum mechanics, and things are very confusing when you talk about quantum mechanics. So I'll give you a hint that George's discovery is much less classical than his father JJ's. JJ determined specifically that the electron was a particle. So that in mind, anyone want to hazard a guess what George's conclusion was?
Also a wave?
Yes, indeed. JJ determined it was a particle and got a Nobel Prize. George determined it was wave and got a prize. George experimented and showed that electrons undergo diffraction. Diffraction is a wave phenomena, not a particular phenomena. There was another guy doing pretty much the same experiment, and both of them announced their results almost simultaneously, and they shared the prize. So you can only imagine what father and son would talk about at times. The fact that both of them got Nobel Prizes for conflicting ideas of what electron are. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
Question, AC2LR.
Yes, Kay.
What is the difference between a spectroscope and a spectrometer? AC2LR.
I think it's basically the same thing. I mean, I haven't really looked it up. It's scope, and onomy is science of, and scope is the visual device. So it's basically the same concept. Most spectroscopy is related to either the absorption or emission of photons due to transition of electrons from one orbital to another orbital. That goes way, way back, and that was how helium was first discovered. It was discovered as a spectral line in the sun, and no one had the faintest idea what it was, because there was no free helium easily available for experimentation. Only later, when they found uranium ore that was giving off alpha particles, which are basically helium, were they able to trap enough helium and do spectroscopy. Mass spectroscopy is to me a little bit of a misnomer, because it's not really related to a photon emission. It's related, as I said, to the way that a charged particle diverts through a electric or magnetic field. It has to do mostly with its mass-to-charge ratios. Even though it's called spectroscopy, mass spectroscopy, I don't know really why. I think it's more historical than anything else. But that's my understanding of the difference between spectronomy and spectroscopy.
I had asked what was the difference between a spectroscope and a spectrometer, like the spectrometer. I was thinking it might measure something slightly different, but that's fine. Thank you. If you have an answer, that's great. If not, thank you for the information you just gave. AC2LR.
Okay, thanks, Kay. I will actually look it up to double check on my stuff there, but I don't think there's any kind of incredible difference between the two devices. They work on the same principle. They might work in a slightly different method, but the underlying principle would be the same.
Okay, great. Thank you. AC2LR.
You're welcome, Kay. So the bottom line of this little Nobel Prize-winning contest between Falk and Hunt, it is the wave-particle duality that quantum mechanics has given us, unfortunately. And as Richard Feynman once said, if you think that you understand quantum mechanics, then you don't understand quantum mechanics. I have another little puzzle. It's a very funny one, and I just basically gleaned it from a book. He asked the question, if you took a mosquito, a common small mosquito, and if you were somehow able to remove all of his electrons and just leave the protons in his atom, the electron repulsion force of all the protons in a simple small mosquito, what kind of an explosion would some disaster like that be? Do you think it would be a firecracker? Do you think it would be a stick of dynamite? We talked about dynamite earlier. And would you think it would be on the order of an H-bomb, or do you think it would be on the order of something terrible like a global extinction event?
H-bomb.
Okay, we have a vote for H-bomb. Anyone else?
Global extinction.
We have a vote for global extinction and a vote for H-bomb. Anyone else?
Solar elimination. Entire solar system.
I think we're getting a little bit too aggressive with this, but okay. So you want to go even outside the four choices into a fifth choice. Anyone else with any suggestions?
One.
Excuse me, say again. Well, you have to consider that electromagnetism is a much greater force than gravity. I mean, we tend to think of gravity more than anything else, I guess, because we're involved with it a lot more than we are with electrostatic charges. But electromagnetism is on an order of something like 10 to the 36. That's one with 36 zeros times stronger than what we call gravity. And so if you had a mosquito and somehow, and I don't know how you would do it, remove all the electrons, the total protons in a small mosquito would probably be the same as the major extinction event that may or may not have killed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. So it wouldn't blow up the world, but it would certainly stub its toe. Any questions or comments before I move on to the next item? Okay, well, we all remember the super blood wolf moon we were all talking about last week. Well, it turned out to be more special than we thought it would be. Sunday night to Monday morning, much anticipated super blood wolf moon eclipse did not disappoint. Millions of people gazed into the night sky or onto video feeds to see a coppery red hue envelope our planet's natural satellites. As the January 21st eclipse unfolded, however, some observers noted a tiny glitch while watching the online broadcast, reported New Scientist, the article. Some suspected the flash was caused by a meteorite strike, and it turned out that it was. Astronomers confirmed these suspicions, tweeting that a lunar impact occurred at 5:41 a.m. Spanish Peninsula time. A photograph released by this astronomer clearly showed a yellow dot appearing in the darkened top left quadrant of the moon during the totality phase of the eclipse. Astronomers have filmed impact flashes on the moon before, but this is the first time a lunar eclipse was captured during a lunar impact, an achievement more than 20 years in the making. Let me drop for a second. Astronomers first started to systematically monitor impact flashes in 1997, an effort that evolved into the Moon Impact Detection and Analysis System, or the MIDAS survey. The telescopes used by MIDAS are equipped with high-sensitivity video cameras and record video continuously during the observing session. These videos are then analyzed by software, which automatically identifies lunar impact flashes and calculates their position on the Moon. The system can detect the moment of an impact flash to an accuracy of about 0.001 seconds. Since 2015, the team has applied photometric filters to some of their telescopes, allowing them to determine the temperature of these flashes. Let me drop for a second. As noted, MIDAS had, prior to the other day, never captured a meteorite strike during a total lunar eclipse. But it wasn't for lack of trying. Weather permitting, every lunar eclipse has been monitored since the survey started. Other groups have also tried to detect lunar flashes during an eclipse, but none succeeded until now. Astronomers said the off-impact flash of this magnitude is about once every 7 to 10 days. The survey team hasn't analyzed all the data yet, but a preliminary guess is that the object is likely a tiny asteroid with a mass of about 22 pounds. By studying these flashes, scientists can acquire better statistics about the rate of lunar impact and, by consequence, the rate at which the Earth's atmosphere is pelted by similar-sized objects. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2LR?
Yes, Kay.
You know how we hear about all these near Earth asteroids? I always wondered why aren't they hitting the moon if there's so many asteroids that we have to worry about? And there you go. They are hitting the moon. I didn't realize it. AC2LR.
Yes, Kay, that they are. I mean, most of them are small. A lot of small bits and pieces are falling into Earth's gravity as well. It's a never-ending thing, and hopefully it'll be small and light and not cause anyone any problems. But yeah, it's part of life, unfortunately. It's what gave the lunar surface that cratering effect, especially the big ones. But the small ones are there too. So yeah, it's kind of, we don't really think of it that much because no one's going to really tell you the weather on the moon, because there aren't that many people really need that information on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, yeah, there's things that fall from the sky onto the moon.
At Casey, KD2 IVP?
Yes, IVP.
I think the moon has less of an atmosphere, so part of, anything that hits the moon isn't subject to the same restrictions that the atmosphere on Earth gives it, and the stuff that comes to Earth may burn up and have less of an impact than it would on the moon. KD2IVP.
Yes, you are quite right. The moon really has no atmosphere to speak of. So there is no there's no burning up in the atmosphere that many meteorites have happened to them on Earth. Some make it all the way down, and some of the earliest iron that was used by civilization is thought to have originated as meteor iron. So some of it reaches us, but a lot of it burns out up in the atmosphere, and the moon doesn't have an atmosphere for it to burn up, so it kind of makes those unfortunate craters in the surface.
AC2LR.
Yes, Gary.
Exactly what KD2IVP was saying is what made me curious about asteroids hitting the moon, because if you look at maps of the moon from, say, like the 16 or 1700s, the same mare and the same craters are there. There's no new features. I don't think that anyone has changed anything about the map of the moon. So whatever impact is happening must be really minimal, or at least not visible by our lunar orbiters or anything like that. AC2LR.
Well, yes, Kay, I would agree completely. It is much more common for small rocks to fall out of the sky than big rocks. And small rocks leave very small craters that most imaging resolutions really won't appreciate. I'm sure if you got an ultra-high resolution scan of the small areas of the moon, you might make out the slight differences as little things come falling down on it. But it happens, you know, as I mentioned, you know, 7 to 10 days, but they're relatively small, and unless you exactly knew what you were looking at, you would see the impact maybe if it was in the right position, but otherwise it would be kind of difficult to resolve with most of our imaging technology still.
Comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the map is of the moon is relatively unchanged is because the moon is locked facing us. The side of the moon that's facing us is locked in that position. Most of the impacts happen on the other side, just because the Earth sort of shields it from these impacts. So it's not that it doesn't get a lot of them. Matter of fact, the pictures of the other side of the moon are, you can see it's much more highly impacted, if you will. There may be someone who could explain it better than I, but anyway, so, you know, unless you can see the other side, our view of the moon does not give an accurate depiction of the amount of impacts that it receives. AC2GS KC2SHL.
Yes, that's quite true. The far side of the moon, and it'll be interesting to see. I think the Chinese are working on setting up equipment for the far side of the moon. So it'll be interesting to see. I agree with you. It's probably a much more active area because the Earth tends to gravitationally shield the tidally locked a portion of the moon. But I would still be sort of surprised if there's anything dramatic. If you did a time-lapse photography of the far side of the moon over, say, 10 or 20 years, whether you would be able to notice. I mean, ultimately, it would be a function of the resolution of the imagery. But it just generally speaking, a full-frame, you know, 8x10 glossy of the far side of the moon, doing, you know, a time step through 10 years if it would be noticeable to anyone.
WS2N.
Yes, but...
We got the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's been going around since 2009. That's been taking really detailed pictures of both sides of the moon, you know, on a regular basis. So I'm sure they could compare that 10 years, you know, difference. You know, they have very good close-ups. I'm sure they'd be able to find quite a few different craters, but nothing big. You know, you're not going to find anything big like the most of the Great Bombardment, you know, when, you know, 4 billion years ago or something, whatever it was. That's what created all those big craters on the moon. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, I agree with you, Paul, but I think last week I did a story about how, for some odd reason, around 250 million years ago, there was an upswing in large bombardments on the moon and probably on Earth. So although it's been steadily declining over the last few billion years, there was a little bump up about 250 million years ago. It's just sort of interesting. You don't sort of think about it, but it's happening with incredible regularity up there.
KD2 IBP.
Yes, IBP.
You think the Earth gets its butt kicked just as much as the Moon or any other satellite in close proximity in this solar system, but the Earth has a tendency to hide a lot of the bombardment, you know, through erosion. We have rain, we have atmosphere, we have water, we have all kinds of things that hide impacts that are happening the same on the moon, that being our closest satellite. So just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. It's just hidden a little bit more, I think. KD2 IBP.
No, I completely agree with you. Matter of fact, the story last week was that they extrapolated the collisions that happened to the moon with what may or may not have happened to the Earth, because we're so close to each other, and although we have a lot of more active areas where erosion and such obscure the telltale signs, the moon doesn't have much in the way of erosion. And it becomes more obvious. So they were extrapolating the indications of meteorite strikes to the moon to the Earth, and a few of the rather large meteorites that left such an indelible print that it was difficult for even erosion to remove them. But I agree with you. It's much more difficult to perceive meteorite collisions on the Earth because of the constant active nature of this crust of ours.
And just a quick note, again, we don't have that, the moon doesn't have that atmosphere, and it's also six times less the mass, so it's not going to allow the collision to be as significant as it would be on Earth, my thinking. KD2 IBB.
Oh, yes, to a degree, yes. But all things, unfortunately, it tends to be complicated. The Earth has less gravitational force on these heavenly bodies, so that's a factor. But the Earth has a atmosphere that you mentioned that burns a lot of these meteorites before they even hit the ground or shatters it into a million pieces. So six to one, half a dozen to the other. It's complicated, but it's interesting that these things are happening all around us, and thankfully it doesn't impact our immediate life.
Another side note, KC2SHO.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I don't know if it's new news, or relatively new, or if it's just something that's been, regurgitated to get to the audience, but I've seen stories saying that Jupiter and its size and its gravity helps to shield the inner planets from these other objects, whatever they are, comets, asteroids, whatever, that gravity helps to keep things from hitting us. I wonder if you had anything more on that. KC2GS, KC2SHO.
Well, I don't know. I don't have anything specific about that. There is a lot in the literature that mentions that the distant giant planets of both Saturn and Jupiter are strong gravitational magnets that keep our area a little bit clearer than they would be without them. And so we're thankful, I guess, for that. And also, Jupiter and Saturn have their own very strong Lagrange points where a lot of asteroids are kind of locked into Lagrange point forces, kind of stabilizing them in those areas. And you have those clusters of meteorites and comets and other such things out there. So yeah, I would agree that it's certainly in the literature. I don't have any specific examples, of course, but the large giants far out there do kind of clear the way a little bit for us. So we still have asteroid belts that we have to deal with, but thankfully far less than they do out there in the farther reaches of the solar system. Any other questions?
Real good.
Before
also,
I move on
we
to
space, this is called galaxy.
Astronomical night, so we're going to
come in and out of more
about other things, astronomical. So
understand the things that I've read probably in that one of the reasons we've been able to sort of progress as human beings or all life on Earth, if you will, is that it's been a relatively quiet time. There aren't a lot of asteroids and other objects around to give us a whole lot of trouble. And the record that they say history shows that there was a much more violent time. Anyway, just a thought, things that I've read over the years. I'll be quiet after that. EC2, GS, KC2, SHO.
No problem, John. If you have any thoughts, feel free to express them. We seem to be very benefiting from a whole bunch of different things that could have made this world much more difficult. If we didn't have a large enough, tidally locked moon, there wouldn't be a degree of stabilization on the planet, and probably there would be a lot more seasonal variations and climate changes that would have swamped to what has happened to us with ice ages and other such. So it's very fortuitous. The sun is the size it is, that we're the distance we are from it, that we have a large moon stabilizing our spin, and that we have large giant planets outer orbit pretty much clearing away for us. So and that we have a magnetic field here that protects us from a lot of radiation. So we're just, I guess, lucky that way. Although science hates the idea of luck, but nevertheless, we seem to be lucky.
The Goldilocks planet, right? And maybe it's just happenstance rather than luck. All right, KC2, SHO, but
the answer to that people give you is, if we weren't fortunate, then there would be no human beings asking why we were fortunate. So it's a kind of self-fulfilling type of a thing. But I'll take it no matter what the reasoning behind. The probability of you existing in this world is infinitesimally small. If you realize every base pair in your DNA that's required for you to be you. And even that's not really you, because you could have a twin that definitely isn't you but has the same base pairs. But nevertheless, the probability of you existing in this universe is as close to zero as you can imagine, and yet here we are talking to each other here. At least I hope we are. Okay, on that philosophical note, I will move on to the next astronomical Okay, have you ever picked up some odd piece of hardware at a ham fest for a ridiculously low price, only to realize that you once sold this exact same piece of junk to some other poor guy many ham fests ago? It hasn't happened to me either, but it sounds like the basis for a really good story. Now, surprisingly, something very similar to that may have happened to Apollo 14 astronauts. A reanalysis of lunar material collected during the Apollo 14 mission has resulted in a rather astonishing conclusion. One of the rocks brought back appears to contain a small chunk of Earth dating back to some 4 billion years ago. Incredibly, it's now possibly amongst the oldest terrestrial rocks known to exist. New research published this week in Earth and Planetary Science Letters is claiming that a rock fragment embedded within a lunar sample, designated 14321, they do have a knack for naming these things, a 2-pound rock known as Big Bertha is of terrestrial origin. Let me drop for a second. The fragments likely reached the moon's surface after an asteroid or comet smashed into the Earth, flinging debris into space. The lead authors of the new study say this happened around 4 billion years ago during the Hadean Aeon, a time when the fledgling Earth was regularly struck by large objects. Big Bertha was collected by NASA astronauts Alan Shepard and Edgar Mitchell in 1971 during the Apollo 14 mission to Frau Mauro Formation. This rock, along with other lunar samples, are stored at the Lunar Information Facility at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. Sample 14321 is special in that it's called class-rich, a crystalline matrix breccia. In layman's term, it means that this rock is made from a jumble of previously existing rocks and rock fragments, as well as melt and impactor material formed during a large impactor series of impacts on the moon. Remarked a scientist not involved in this paper. He described it as a treasure trove containing a multitude of classes of rocks. Let me drop for a second. Sample 14321 has been recognized as being unusual for a long time, and only now are we appreciating how truly unusual it really is. Packed within this lunar breccia is a 2-gram felsite class, a fine-grained volcanic rock, felsite fragments, including quartz, feldspar, and zircon. These materials are commonly found on Earth, but are very uncommon on the Moon, and indeed, a chemical analysis of the sample suggests it formed under terrestrial rather than lunar conditions. They use the composition of minerals in the fragment to show it formed under conditions that only occur on Earth. The composition of certain minerals is sensitive to temperature and pressure. They contain more or less of various elements if they crystallize in hot or cool and or deep or shallow environments. Other minerals can indicate rock formed in the presence of lots of oxygen or in an oxygen-poor environment. Their data showed that this fragment formed in a high-pressure, more oxygen-rich, and lower-temperature environment than occurs on the Moon. Essentially, it had to come from an Earth-like environment. Let me drop. Obviously, the Moon just happened to have an Earth-like environment right there in the form of Earth. That an ancient asteroid strike could have thrown chunks of terrestrial debris into space and onto the Moon's surface is not a completely ridiculous idea. Back during the Hadean Aeon, asteroids regularly produced craters thousands of kilometers in diameter. Impacts of this magnitude were capable of pulling out material from deep within the Earth's surface. The apparent terrestrial fragment found within Big Bertha formed around 12 miles below the Earth's surface, a depth not out of reach for these ancient asteroids. Another possibility, according to the new research, is that the fragment crystallized on the Moon, but for this to happen, the material had to have formed deep within the Moon, near its lunar mantle, and there's no good reason for it to reach the surface. The simpler explanation, the researchers said, is that it came from Earth. Let me stop for a second. Speaking of the lunar surface, it seems surprising that the Apollo astronauts were able to find this breccia so easily. Indeed, billions of years of steadily accumulating lunar dust, known as regolith, should have obscured traces of this rock. But apparently, Big Bertha was covered in regolith, just not enough to bury it completely. To explain its presence on the lunar surface, the breccia was once buried, but it returned to the surface following an impact that formed the Cone Crater, a 1,000-foot crater near the Apollo 14 landing site. Said to be a very common process on the moon. Let me drop for a second. A fascinating aspect of this discovery is that this lunar sample of apparent terrestrial origin is truly ancient, an estimated 4 to 4.1 billion years old. The terrestrial zircon mineral found in the sample is now among the oldest known to exist. A University Space Research Association press release went so far as to proclaim it as Earth's oldest rock, but that's not entirely accurate, according to other geologists. The age of the zircon mineral found in the lunar sample is quoted at circa 4.01 billion years old, which makes it a very old piece of Earth. This research is correct, but it's not the oldest, they said. There are zircons on Earth of 4.4 and 4.3 billion years, which come from Western Australia. The authors of the new study presented two possibilities to explain this anomalous sample. Either it formed on Earth, which is very likely, or it formed deep within the moon, which seems highly unlikely. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2LR.
Yes, Kay.
I love how they covered all bases. Either it formed on the Earth or it formed on the moon. And I thought you were reading the article. I was thinking, you know how they're discovering water on the moon. I wonder now if the water was encapsulated in something that was knocked off of Earth, that was formed on Earth, and traveled to the moon that way. AC2LR.
Well, that's possible, but you have to also realize that there's a lot of icebergs floating in space as well. So it's not bizarre to think that falling objects that are not related to our planet are rich in water. So that's also a possibility, and that's probably a more likely source for the water than I think it bouncing off us and hitting the moon.
Question, KD2IBP.
Yes, IBP.
Yeah, I stepped out for a couple minutes there, but it was my understanding, you know, I didn't research this to any great depth, but that an asteroid may have hit the Earth so hard that it knocked a chunk of material off of the Earth, but probably in particles that congealed to become that moon. What do we think about that, KD2IBP?
I think you're reading my mind, because that's part of the subject of the next subject.
Okay, so I'll be on the side listening, always.
Okay, any other questions or comments?
Well, I wonder, just thinking with no real knowledge on the subject, if that happened like they say, water would tend to maybe break apart into very small particles and not get a lot of, maybe not be able to get away from gravity so easily, where a large chunk could really make the distance. I don't know, just a thought. KC2SHO.
Well, yeah, I would agree that you're not going to get water droplets, but you could get large, Antarctic ice. If a big enough meteorite slammed into the Antarctic, I could make a case for a big iceberg snapping apart and rebounding into space and maybe coming to land on the moon. That's a possibility.
AC2LR?
Yes, Kay.
So just like Big Bertha, I mean, things are escaping from Earth with enough impact power and traveling to the moon, obviously. I'm wondering, this is a different tangent, but how would water form? Two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen out in space, don't they have to form somewhere like in an environment of Earth? And I guess if there's a chemist in the listening audience, they might know. Or Roy, you seem to know. This is AC2LR.
Well, when the universe supposedly finished with its early Big Bang, we were left with approximately 90% hydrogen and 10% helium. From that, large stars formed that burned very hot and very quickly and exploded. And as a large sun burns, it uses nuclear fuel. Our sun basically burns hydrogen into helium. It's a rather small, slow-burning sun. But a bigger one will burn material all the way down to iron. And when the supernova, the additional force will cause even heavier metals and elements to be formed, to pass uranium. The heaviest natural element we know is uranium, because the heavier elements are less stable and they decay into lighter elements. But there's a lot of hydrogen, there's a load of hydrogen out there, and there's a lot of oxygen. And all you need is a collection of hydrogen and oxygen under any kind of environment and a little bit of energy to start the chemical reaction going, and you will get water. It's a very common substance in the universe, thankfully. There are planets almost made out of water. There are moons and such that are mostly made out of water. So it's a nice thing. But you don't need a planet to make water, per se. You just need some gravitational force and a supply of oxygen to go with all the hydrogen that's almost everywhere.
WS2S.
Yes, Paul.
Good example of water being created is the space shuttle. So you look at the all coming out of the bottom of the three engines on the space shuttle, not the solid boost, but the three engines on the shuttle, and that was being fed by that main tank. External tank, and that had nothing but pure oxygen, and liquid hydrogen, and that was being combusted in those RS-25 engines, those three engines. And when looked at that smoke, that was not regular smoke. That was actual steam that being created just from that reaction alone. So. There you go. That's one, good example of how easy it's created. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, Paul. Hydrogen, the bonds of H2 and hydrogen and the bonds of O2 and oxygen are weaker than the OH bonds of water molecules. And so if you put water and if you put hydrogen, you put oxygen together and give it just a little spark, a little chemical push, they'll go down the free energy slope and give off heat and energy and turn into water. Water is a much lower chemical energy containing molecule than the original hydrogen, dihydrogen gases and the dioxygen gases. So it's rather easy chemistry, thankfully, and very useful, because basically, human beings, the cells in our bodies, we kind of took the sea with us. If you take a look at what's in the sea, the amount of salt, the type of salt, and the water and such, it's very close to the climate inside of each one of our individual animal cells. So it's interesting how, although we left the sea, we kind of drag it around with us in little cells in our body. Questions or comments, or I'll move on to my last little story here that has to do with what we were talking to IVT about. For those that might find Genesis' account on how life began too simple, and others that are aware of Stanley Miller and Curie's revolutionary finding that primordial earth compounds with a bit of lightning can form pre-life organic molecules too easily? Here's a theory to add another cataclysmic, complicated layer to this tale. New research suggests that much of the material that made life possible on Earth arrived after a cataclysmic collision between our planet and a Mars-sized object billions of years ago. Likely the same collision that produced the moon, the scientists say. For life to emerge on an otherwise dead planet, an assortment of chemical compounds or volatile elements are required, including carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur. Conventional thinking has it that the Earth's volatile elements arrive through the steady bombardment of ancient meteorites. Now, new research published recently in Science Advances proposes an alternative delivery mechanism, a catastrophic collision between the Earth and a Mars-shaped-sized object, sometimes referred to as Theia, some 4.4 billion years ago. This hypothetical collision, which would have happened while our planet was still forming, seeded our baby planet with the volatile elements required for life, according to this new paper. What's more, the lead authors of the new study say it's the same planet-on-planet collision that formed the moon. Let me drop for a second. For many astronomers, geologists, and astrobiologists, the notion that the Earth's volatiles arrived on the back of primitive meteorites has never been completely satisfying. Our planet, along with other rocky planets in the inner solar system, is naturally bereft of volatiles. It just so happens that the isotopic signature of Earth's volatiles match those seen in carbonaceous chondrites, the class of meteorites typically cited as being the deliverers of volatiles on Earth. The problem is the volatile element ratios, such as carbon to nitrogen and water to carbon. In Earth's silicate mantle, crust, ocean, and atmosphere are out of whack with what's observed in chondrites, leading to a so-called isotope crisis and doubts about the meteorite seeding theory. The new study is interesting in that it offers a solution to this problem, but instead of invoking a plethora of small meteorite strikes, the authors propose a single gigantic collision between the Earth and an ancient planet. Let me drop for a second. The basis for this claim comes from an experiment in which the researchers attempted to mimic the conditions of this impact in the lab. The study involved high pressure and temperature experiments, along with computer simulations fed with information gleaned from these experiments. Through this modeling work, the researchers sought to determine the size and chemical composition of the impacting planet to see how its reservoir of silicates could have mixed with the Earth, delivering its various life essential elements. In 2016, one of the co-authors of this new study authored a similar paper showing how the amount of fractionation of carbon and sulfur within the silicates of our planet could be explained by a gigantic collision with another planet. The new experiment is different in that it investigated the fate of three life-essential volatile elements, carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur, in the wake of a cataclysmic impact involving two young rocky planets, in addition to providing an estimate for the size of the hypothetical impactor. Let me drop for a second. Quote, carbon and sulfur alone, unfortunately, cannot provide a solution to the origin of volatiles on Earth, end quote. One of the co-authors opined, without nitrogen, Earth's carbon and sulfur could have come from primitive meteorites as well. He explained, because the carbon to sulfur ratio of the silicates in Earth is similar to those in the chondrites. What we show in current work, he said, is that when one considers carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur together, delivery via a giant impact or merger of a proto-Earth with a Mars-sized planet is the most likely solution, he says. To simulate the conditions of this alleged planetary smash-up, scientists heated and pressurized material thought to exist within the Earth during its developmental stage. This was done to replicate, at least in microcosm, the conditions on Earth in depths between 25 to 75 miles. These materials, which included silicates and an iron-nickel alloy, were then mixed with sulfur, carbon, and nitrogen, representing the chemical contributions of the embryonic Mars-sized planet. The researchers carefully watched the behavior of these materials while tweaking a number of variables. Let me drop for a second. Results showed that carbon was less likely to bond with the metallic iron that was mixed with alloys rich in nitrogen and sulfur. At the same time, the nitrogen remained unaffected by the sulfur. quote, what they found is that when there is a lot of sulfur in the system, the element carbon behaves differently than nitrogen and doesn't go into metal as readily, and can lead to a ratio of these elements that matches the modern-day Earth's ratio of these elements. A scientist not involved in this research remarked, the researchers also showed that volcanic glass on the moon and bulk silicates of Earth have similar isotopic signatures, pointing to a common origin. The most likely explanation, the researchers argue, is a massive impact with a Mars-sized planet, a collision that not only delivered most of our planet's carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur, but also produced the moon. Let me drop for a second. Quote, our study challenges the existing models of volatile elements delivery methods, end quote, one of the researchers stated. It also solves the long-standing problem that the volatile element ratios of the surface layer of Earth are distinctly different from the planet-forming building blocks that we know as chondrites. According to the new paper, the proto-Earth silicate shell, before it collided with the moon-forming impactor, at least in this scenario, is poor in carbon, sulfur, and nitrogen. In reality, according to a fellow scientist not involved in this paper, the abundance of these elements in the Earth's mantle before the moon-forming impact is unknown. Also, the scenario posited by the researchers appears to assume that the sulfur-rich metal core of the planetary embryo falls into the Earth's core without ever interacting with silicate shell, and many simulations suggest that this is not necessarily the case, and so this may be oversimplified. Let me drop for a second. As for comparing nitrogen and hydrogen with lunar volcanic glass to the composition of the Earth and then claiming a common origin, some scientists not involved in this paper were reportedly unconvinced. In themselves, the pyroclastic glass from the moon are complicated volcanic rocks, and the cause of hydrogen and nitrogen enrichment in these samples is still controversial, a scientist stated. Furthermore, in linking the moon-forming impact with the nitrogen-carbon-sulfur enrichment, several studies have argued that the Earth-moon-forming impactor may have been smaller or larger than a Mars-sized body without violating geochemical constraints. Ultimately, the new paper is useful for understanding the behavior of carbon, sulfur, and nitrogen in relatively small planetary embryo sizes, and may also be important for understanding how these volatiles behave within Mars. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. IVP, is that what you were looking for?
Directed towards whom?
D2IVP.
Oh, this is IBP. All this is just reiterating stuff that I have already read over the course of time. But what made you think that you should read that to me? Not saying that you're wrong, KD2IBP.
Didn't do it specifically for you. It was the next one on my list. It's a new study. It was just published. So if you read about it years ago, then I don't know what to tell you, but this is a new study.
Hey, all right, not blasting the new study, but it kind of sounds like the old study, no?
Old study was the origin of the moon. The new study is that the chemicals necessary and the quantities for producing life on Earth came from that secondary planet collision. That's the new little nuance on this particular study.
The chemicals involved, as you read them, were the chemicals that you would cause an explosion with, sulfur, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon. But as far as life is concerned, they had suggested, the infamous day, that may have come from a rock flying onto the Earth. That's new to me.
Okay, well the old theory that's been around for more than a few years was it was a kind of accretion of meteorites that seeded the surface of the crust with those volatile elements. This new concept is that it wasn't just a lot of separate small meteorites, that it was the same exact object that gave us ultimately the moon. That's the difference.
Okay, that's old news. I'm not going to take up too much of the time on the net for this one, but has anybody created life on Earth with the elements, just the root elements? KD2AB pick?
No, no one's created life because life is incredibly complicated. If you ever look up a chart of biochemical synthesis, it will give you a nosebleed. It is very, 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 very complicated. What has happened in the 50s, two smart guys, Urey and Miller, put a bunch of very simple chemicals into a flask and exposed them to arcing, and then took the sludge that was produced and found that there were a lot of organic compounds that were present in living things. But creating a living thing from a non-living thing, we haven't quite gotten that far yet.
Roger that. Big difference from theoretical science to applied science. So I'll yield my time to you. KD2IVP.
Very well. Anyone with any comments or questions before I roll this up for the night?
WS2M, didn't they get amino acids out of that mixture?
There were a whole bunch of organic compounds. There were a lot of organic compounds that don't really belong in anything that we know of, but it included precursor amino acids and such. It was a fascinating study that only goes to show how much elements sort of want to form into organic compounds.
Very good. You gave it a name. Thought it was a C. Doride or something like that. And they think that the moon Titan has the same chemicals on it now. And, you know, that might be like a pre-Earth. You know, Titan's going around Saturn. But, okay. Yeah, I remember studying it. The reason I remember it is one of their students, I believe one of their students was Carl Sagan. So you know, he was working with them. These guys are doing that. Back to you, Ron.
Hey, thanks, Paul. That's interesting to hear. I didn't consider that. I don't know if they worked out of Cornell. I know he did a lot of his work in Cornell. This wasn't. I think this was primarily chemists, Urey and Miller. I didn't kind of look into seeing if they were non-chemists. It always struck me that this was a kind of a chemistry sort of thing to do. And Carl Sagan, of course, was an astronomer. So I got to look that up too. That's very good, Paul. Thanks a lot. Anyway, it's been fun, and I thank everyone who participated, and we'll be back next week with some more topics and hopefully some puzzlers. And once again, if you want to read up on any of these things that I'm mentioning, go to roy.ac2gs.com, and it will be posted there. And if you have any questions or topics or anything you need to tell me, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. So I will pass it back to Dick so that he can pass it to Paul. Thank you very much.
Good stuff, Paul. Roy, I do remember reading that the Harold Urey and Stanley Miller experiment, they did derive something like 12 or 13 of the basic amino acids. And when they investigated the leftover materials at a later time with more sensitive instrumentation, they found an even greater number of amino acids that formed sort of automatically with that spark and heating experiment of so-called inert materials. So one possible suggestion, I think they did that at the University of Chicago, but I'm not sure. One possible suggestion, though, is that the amino acids will form under natural conditions. Those are the precursors of life. So there are people who are very optimistic who think that if you wait long enough, life will crawl out of that flask. But that's an awful lot of optimism. But you do have a very big planet with an awful lot of material interacting. And there is that universal so-called theory that when you have enough material interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. And so the forming of the amino acids and eventually forming life, you could read as being spontaneous and can't be avoided if you wait long enough. But you've got to be a bit optimistic for that. A lot of missing steps in there, of course. Paul, your signal is a little bit noisy tonight. Is your antenna aimed correctly? Are you running your normal power? WS2N?